Welcome to State of the State, the monthly roundup of all things political and economic in the state of Michigan, brought to you by the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University and produced by the fine folks here at WKAR Studios. I'm Charles Ballard. I'm a professor in the Department of Economics at MSU, and I'm the director of the State of the State Survey, which is part of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research. And our guest is Matt Grossman, who is professor of political science, and also he's the director of the Institute. So welcome, Matt.
Great to be with you.
Sure. So we were talking about a couple of things that are of note going on in Michigan. One is the economy.
Yeah. Is President Trump going to have a lot of new factory openings to visit and take credit for?
It sure is not looking like it. The economy in the Midwest, the upper Midwest, has been struggling. In Michigan, there has been no job growth since January. In Ohio and Indiana, they've actually lost a few thousand jobs. So while the nation as a whole has gained 1.2 million jobs this year, none of that has been happening in this part of the country.
And this isn't just a temporary GM strike issue.
No, this is something that preceded the General Motors strike. Basically, even before the GM strike, manufacturing was flat, has been flat for a while. And since manufacturing is a big part of the economy in this part of the country, that has negative implications for our economy. The Michigan economy, if you measure it not in terms of jobs but in terms of gross domestic product, actually shrank in the fourth quarter of last year. It's grown some since then, but very, very sluggish growth even when it's growing. That doesn't mean we're necessarily in a recession, but it does mean that we're sort of on the edge of a recession in Michigan. And I wrote recently in Crane's Detroit Business that addressing the question of whether we're prepared for the next one, and I think the answer is no. With all of the unfunded liabilities and the roads unfixed and a whole bunch of unmet needs that I really think we would have been much wiser to address seriously in 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, when the economy was growing fairly robustly.
And there was a lot of talk in the last recession about the need to diversify away from the auto industry in Michigan. To what extent has that proceeded?
Well, we've diversified some. In fact, we've diversified a lot. You go back to the 60s, the motor vehicle sector was one-fourth of our economy, which is really remarkable. And, of course, a lot of the rest of the economy was things that revolved around autos. Now it's 8% of our economy. So in that sense, we're more diversified. The challenge, of course, is that there's two ways to diversify. You can diversify by adding new things, and we've done plenty of that, but you can also diversify by losing the thing you used to have, and we've done so much of that Michigan has slipped in the last half century from an above-average income state to a below-average income state. So that was one of the maybe not so happy pieces of news that we were talking about when we were getting ready for this show.
Yeah, historically, the economy obviously has a lot to do with politics and election results.
Yes.
That relationship is actually going down over time as we're now a partisan polarized country and people's interpretations of the economy are increasingly colored by their politics. So we saw a fun example of this. The week before President Trump was elected, Democrats were much more positive about the economy. 2 weeks later, after the election, no policies had been implemented, but suddenly the economy had gone south, according to Democrats, and had resurged, according to Republicans. So that means that that he's less dependent than historically presidents would have been. There is still some effects on governors as well. If a state seems to be out of kilter with the national economy, so it's possible that Whitmer would get some of the blame. How do you see things proceeding?
Well, good news for Governor Whitmer. She's got three more years before she would stand for re-election. The election in 2020, I imagine we'll have some other opportunities to talk about that.
We should in the
next year. I think a great deal depends upon who is the Democratic nominee, and because the Democratic candidates, of course, cover a very a very wide range of policy stances, and so we'll stay tuned. We'll talk about that on many an occasion going forward. Another one that we were talking about was Senator Shirky, the Senate Majority Leader in the state legislature here in Michigan, has been talking recently about term limits. And most Michiganders, I think, are aware that we have term limits on our legislature. They were instituted back in the 90s. And they say that if you're in the House of Representatives, you can serve no more than 3 2-year terms for a total of 6. And if you're in the Senate, you can serve no more than 2 4-year terms for a total of 8 years. So the maximum is 14 years in the legislature for an individual. Lots of ordinary citizens, and we've seen this in our polling with the survey, the State of the State survey, the general public seems to be in favor of some sort of term limits, although when we ask people about certain types of reform of the term limits, there's majority support for chiseling away at it. In other words, we're not rigidly set on the kind of term limits that we have, but there seems to be support for some sort of term limits. And I believe Senator Shirky is trying to engender a discussion about relaxing those somewhat. What do you think about that?
Well, it's a long-running trend that elites are less thrilled with term limits than the public. Anybody who's been around Lansing for a while tends to see with term limits the lobbyists gaining power, the administrators gaining power. That's consistent with the evidence across states in terms of what term limits have wrought. They don't seem to have had huge policy effects across the states. It's more just about sort of where the centers of power lie. But to the extent that we have evidence, you know, experienced legislators are good for driving policy and things like, you know, policy being copied by other states or winning awards and those kinds of things. It's more helpful to have more experienced legislators.
So, yeah. There's nowhere else in our society that we routinely give a whole lot of power to amateurs,
exactly.
People who haven't had much experience.
But I don't know that it's going to change much on the public side. Even in the Democratic primary, Tom Steyer is running 80% of all ads right now in the early primary states, and about half of them are pro-term limits at the federal level. So even on the Democratic side, you still have the appeal of this kind of anti-politician messaging.
Well, My sense is that the big question is not so much whether there are term limits, but how severe they are. Mm-hmm. And in Michigan, they're pretty severe. And one problem that can happen as a result of very short term limits, I was at a presentation a few years ago by Dave Hollister, a former Democratic representative from Lansing, and Fred Dillingham, former Republican legislator from Livingston County. And they were very proud of the work that they had done on hospice care legislation, but they freely admitted that it had taken them 8 years to get it through the legislature. And if your time horizon, if first of all, you're a rookie and you don't even become aware of an issue until after you've been there for 2 or 3 years, and then by the end of 3 more years, you're out, you may not even try to work on difficult issues, which will take usually a long time to get passed, because lots of new initiatives don't pass the first time, and then you go back and you tweak the legislation, and it takes a while.
Yeah, and you often see these reforms when they do come up kind of paired with other political reforms, because the idea is, well, maybe just reducing the effectiveness or the increasing the length of term limits isn't popular on its own, but if we combine it with some other elements as part of a broader political reform, and I think there is an opening to combine it with things that might be about too much influence in the lobbying sector or too much influence from political political outsiders, because obviously with term limits, you know, that does raise the kind of very quick revolving door issue that as soon as you are term limited out of the legislature, you can go over to the advocacy side.
Well, an awful lot of legislators, I've heard stories of people who basically, as soon as they're in the legislature, what they're doing is they're looking for which lobbying firm they might work with after they're out of the legislature.
Yeah. And so I think there might be some room for public support for some kind of a combined political reform package that included a little bit on the, you know, against revolving door movement from the lobbying, from the legislature to the lobbying sector. And then maybe you could sell it as a empowering initiative for the legislature against outside interests.
One of the things that we asked about in the State of the State survey a few years ago was actually an idea that goes all the way back to ancient Athens, where a public office holder would then have to be out of public office for a number of years before they could come back. And so we asked, what if you've finished your terms, but then you, after 4 years, you can come back? And that had support of more than 60% of the people who when we asked it. So I think there's a variety of reforms that could be considered as part of some package that, and if you tweak the package right, you might be able to get it passed.
And lifetime limits are relatively rare across the states. Most states do let people come back to serve another term after waiting it out.
So in that sense, Michigan is unusually restrictive.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, Matt, I hear that you've got a new book out. Is that right?
That is true.
And it's called Red State Blues. Is that, do I have the title?
You do. So it takes a look at the last three decades of trends in policy and politics in the American states. There has been really quite a Republican revolution under the radar in state governments. In 1992, Republicans controlled only three states fully, the House, Senate, and the governor's office. By 2017, they controlled 26 states fully. They had gone from about 40% in the average state chamber to about 60% across the states. We did see, you know, some Democratic gains in 2018 and in 2019, but Democrats have made up only about what they lost in 2014, not what they've lost over that long period.
Right.
So the goal was to sort of see what have they gained in terms of actual policy results from those gains. And the story is, I think, not as successful as it's sometimes told. The Republicans have passed policies, of course. Policies in some states have been more conservative than they otherwise would have been with Democratic control or mixed control. But there are a couple patterns. First of all, it's very hard to do anything about reversing the growth and the size and scope of state government. That is, Republican control is able to sort of slow that growth, but not to reverse it. So the average state in an average year increases the government spending as a share of the economy by about a fifth of one percentage point, and Republican control is associated with a reduction of about that amount. So you basically have Democrats would sort of be slowly expanding government. Republicans are basically putting the brakes on that.
Not abolishing
exactly
Medicaid or anything like that.
Yeah, and in the states where they did do the most, like a Kansas, you start to see a pretty immediate backlash. We can't just do what we do at the federal level, where we cut taxes and increase spending forever. And so that means forever so far.
forever until the crisis comes, and the problem is you don't know when the world credit markets will lose their appetite for dollar debt. But
you're bringing us back to the bad news again. No.
Okay.
So once you really get, you know, a real reduction in the scope of state government, like we saw in Kansas, you see a pretty immediate backlash. People like the idea in general of lower taxes and less government spending. They really don't like closed schools. So even Republican legislators often reverse themselves when that news comes comes to voters. And you even see elections that show the results of the biggest moves. We actually, of course, saw Democrats win the gubernatorial election in Kansas. We also saw Kentucky last week, Matt Bevin lose in large part because of the teacher walkouts that started his descent in public approval. And that's an interesting story where, you know, six states saw these teacher walkouts. Every single one of them, Republican legislators relented to some extent, increasing education spending and in many cases increasing taxes in response to those teacher strikes.
So it would appear that Republicans have been very successful in terms of their rhetoric, mm-hmm. because everybody hates big government. But a lot of folks may hate big government, but they still want the roads to be paved. They still want good schools. They still want a variety of other things. I'm reminded of the South Carolina woman 10 years ago who shouted at her congressman, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare."
Yes, and I don't want to say that there are no, you know, there are no results, because Medicaid expansion is a good example, right? 14 states refused to expand Medicaid despite a very good deal from the federal government. Those states were overwhelmingly Republican controlled.
Michigan was one of the exceptions.
Was one of the exceptions, but it wasn't an exception in some ways, which is that, you know, 36 states did double the size of their largest program in response to an offer from President Obama at the very height of Republican control of the states. So there's two ways to look at it. On the one hand, a lot more people would have access to Medicaid if Democrats had controlled the states relative to Republicans. On the other hand, the overall trend is still toward an expansion of that program.
And in Michigan, more than 500,000 Michiganders have health insurance more than they had before the Medicaid expansion.
Exactly. And there are places where we've seen more policy change, like abortion, immigration lately, guns, where all states have kind of moved in their right or left direction. But those policies weren't associated with as many actual outcome changes. It's hard to show, for example, that the Republican control of the states has led to a change in the abortion rate in the states or in the gun ownership rate in the states, even in the unionization rate of a state. So even where there have been policies that have passed, they haven't been enough to really kind of change the trajectory of those states.
So there are just some very powerful, very long-term trends that neither Democrats nor Republicans are likely to shift in dramatically.
Right. So we find that, you know, compared to the differences expressed in a campaign between Republicans and Democrats, full Republican control or full Democratic control moves the policy about 1% in their direction.
Moves the needle just a little bit, but not a whole lot.
Yeah, so you see real effects, but they're not, they're not overwhelming. And we also have these just nationwide trends at the same time. So over this period, we saw a lock them up and throw away the key criminal justice policy for a couple of decades. And now pretty much across all of the states, we're seeing a criminal justice reform effort. So a pretty much an exact reversal of previous state policy that has come across the states.
And a big change, since you mentioned it, a big change in Michigan just within the last couple of weeks is the passage of the Raise the Age initiative, where we were one of only a small number of states that treated 17-year-old defendants in the adult criminal justice system, and now the age of majority for criminal justice will be 18 going forward in Michigan. And that's all part of that trend.
Yeah, part of a national trend. And, one we could credit Republicans with. These are core conservative institutions that are behind this criminal justice reform. The Koch brothers, the Federalist Society, the American Legislative Exchange Council. On the other hand, it's a reversal of the previous Republican policy. It's now moving faster in Democratic states than Republican states. So it's hard to kind of credit Republicans with that success.
Well, one part of it, I think, is that Republicans discovered that imprisoning people costs a whole lot of money. I'm a native Texan, and when I was growing up, the Republican Party almost did not exist in Texas. Actually, George H.W. Bush was one of the a real George H.W. Bush was a real pioneer of trying to build the Republican Party. And now, of course, Republicans have complete control in Texas. That's a story that was repeated across the South, in my view, largely in response to the Civil Rights Act. So we have in much of the South, we've gone from very conservative leadership who called themselves Democrats to very conservative leadership who now call themselves Republicans.
Right, but very delayed, right?
So it took a generation.
Yeah, so
it took a generation.
That happened, but it happened in the 1990s.
Right.
So we can still credit, you know, the civil rights changes of the parties, but you know, this is a relatively recent shift.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. It's likely to be relatively permanent, and it was a place that you wouldn't have expected a lot of policy change if you're replacing conservative Democrats with conservative Republicans,
or having conservative Democrats who then change party.
And become a
conservative
right.
Republican.
And that shows up, that those states change less than some other states. There was, you know, they were the smallest governments already, so there
right.
was less to change there. And you compare that with a state where they had more influence, like Wisconsin, and that's a state where policy, Wisconsin by our measures, was like the fifth most liberal state by economic policy at the beginning of this period. And so there, whereas they had basically about an average public in public opinion, and so there Republicans come in and they not only kind of have some policy to potentially shift, but they could argue, I think, that policy was more liberal than the public opinion in the state, and so they were able to move it more there than elsewhere.
Right. One of the things that I'm sure you've discovered in your research, well, you already knew it, but this is an astonishingly heterogeneous country with huge differences among the states.
It is. There are nationwide trends, though, and some of them are good news for liberals. Early childhood education is one of the interesting examples where, at the national level, this was a Hillary Clinton proposal. It was seen as being kind of more on the liberal side. It's a traditional expansion of government responsibility. And yet, almost every governor that was elected last year promised to increase funding for early childhood education, and almost everyone did. And we might even argue that was in response to some research evidence of the importance.
since I'm an economist, I think I'll blow the horn of the economics profession. Many economists, most notably the University of Chicago Nobel laureate Jim Heckman, have really, really publicized the fact that really the early childhood is about the highest paying return on investment that a society can make. And it makes sense when you think about it, because getting that child ready for kindergarten is extraordinarily important. If the child is not ready for kindergarten when he or she gets to the age of kindergarten, well, it's sort of like you're running a marathon and you're not going to start until the others are 5 miles down the road. You might catch up, but it's going to be really hard.
Yeah, and we can hope that eventually, once the evidence gets out there, that it eventually kind of makes its way into the political system. And I think there are actually we've discussed a couple examples of that, of the success of that.
Yeah. So where can I get a copy of your book, Matt?
You can go to Amazon or any place where you normally buy your books pick up a copy. It's called Red State Blues.
Red State Blues.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you for this has been a fun discussion. I've been here with Matt Grossman. I'm Charlie Ballard, and this has been State of the State, and we look forward to seeing you next month.